Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke was published by Harcourt, Brace & World, Incorporated, New York, New York, in 1953. This work of prophetic science fiction was set on Earth in the late 20th through the 21st centuries. The story features Earth's alien master and supervisor, the Overlord Karelin, Secretary General of the UN, Richard Stormgren, Karelin's human liaison, Alexander Wainwright, leader of Earth's Freedom League, an organization fighting against Overlord rule, an enigmatic Overlord researcher in the area of human psychology, Rashavarak, and Jan Rodericks, a restless graduate student. When the Overlords came to Earth in their enormous, gleaming ships, stationing themselves above every major Terran city, humanity was at once alarmed and relieved. For while the conquest of their planet eliminated international conflict, the very soul of humanity, in part defined by that struggle, was also now diminished. Supervisor Karelin, the apparently beneficent overlord who administered Terran affairs through the agency of Envoy Richard Stormgren, Secretary General of the UN, was strangely evasive about his plans for the human race. Regardless, the overlords had ushered in a golden age among the Terrans. With their technologically advanced rule had come true peace, plenty, and freedom for the first time in history. Individuals at last were empowered to pursue any field they chose, albeit with limitations on the exploration of space and certain forms of scientific and artistic experimentation. And with pressure for supporting the arms race tidally removed, the world's wealth nearly doubled. Apart from the question of their ultimate plans for mankind, one other major mystery remained concerning the conquerors: their physical appearance. For whatever reason, the overlords refused to show themselves in the presence of humans. Even Stormgren, the one Earthling authorized to deal directly with Karelin, communicated with the supervisor only through an opaque grill. Alexander Wainwright, the vocal and devoutly religious leader of the planet's Freedom League, had used this argument to stir up a measure of protest against the overlord rule, despite the futility of resistance. "We've lost the freedom to control our own lives," Wainwright warned. Finally, the overlords issued an announcement. "In 50 years, two generations from now, we will come down from our ships, and humanity will at last see us as we are." "In 50 years," scowled Wainwright, "the damage will have been done. Those who remembered our independence will be dead. Humanity will have forgotten its heritage." "Karelin is working for a united world," Stormgren countered, "and I'll do nothing to help his enemies. What his ultimate plans may be, I don't know, but I believe that they are good." Stormgren's faith might have been justified. 50 years later, humanity's new golden age was in full swing. The overlord's laws of benevolence were in force. Religious faith had become a relic of the past. And the mad tempo that had so characterized the 20th century was now a distant memory. Humanity had lost its ancient gods. Now it was old enough to have no need for new ones. And now, at last, Karelin fulfilled his promise. In the presence of worldwide media, the overlord stepped from his ship. A great collective gasp arose from the onlookers. For before them stood the devil himself, horned, black-scaled, barbed-tailed, and standing over 2 meters tall. The most terrible of all legends had come to life out of the unknown past. But after the Terrans' first collective shudders of shock, the Overlord's planetary administration continued without a hitch. Meanwhile, bathed in the golden afterglow of a past that could never return, human civilization drifted on, and no one worried, except a few philosophers. By this time, freed by technology from the need to congregate in cities, humans had begun to emigrate to the far reaches of the globe. It was at one of these remote sites, a house owned by jungle caretaker Rupert Boyce on the southern tip of Africa, that a group of partygoers gathered some years later to commemorate Boyce's latest wedding. Among the celebrants were George Gregson, a noted theater designer, and his attractive and vibrant fiancée, Jean Morrow, a researcher into the occult. The couple were surprised to find an actual overlord also in attendance, a scholarly young devil named Rashavarak, who had come to inspect Boyce's extensive library on paranormal psychology. Also present was the bride's brother, Jan Rodericks, a graduate student in astronomy. As the party finally wound down, Boyce prevailed upon his remaining guests, including Jan, George Gregson, and Jean Morrell, to join him in a seance. Rashavarak, however, elected merely to observe. As the seance unfolded, the Ouija board revealed several baffling messages, including, "Believe in man, nature is with you." Finally, Jan was invited to ask the board a question. Stealing a single glance at the impassive bulk of Rashavarak, the young scientist called out, "Which star is the overlord's sun?" At once, the plate began to move, spelling out the galactic coordinates. NGS 549672. At this point, the seance was interrupted. Jean Morrell, who had stood transfixed throughout the proceedings, suddenly toppled over into a faint. But Jan Rodericks did not forget that configuration. After correlating the figures from the board with the direction in which the overlord ships had been seen to exit the solar system, he contacted a well-known oceanographer, a Dr. Sullivan. At that moment, Sullivan was busy readying a large ocean diorama, specifically a display of a sperm whale fighting a giant squid, for the overlords to take back to their planet for exhibition. Now Jan presented the doctor with a startling proposition. He himself would stow away, Jonah-style, aboard the whale, and visit the overlord's home. Several years passed. George and Jean Gregson were now living with their two young children in a colony on a remote South Pacific island. At first, the colonizers of New Athens had feared that their isolated community of artists and intellectuals would invite the wrath of Karelin. However, the overlords appeared to take little notice of the colony. But the Gregsons were uneasy. Their oldest child, Jeffrey, had begun to experience vividly haunting dreams of exotic, far-off worlds. At last, even the skeptical George began to suspect his son's sleeping mind might be connecting with the aura of some remote universe. Then one night, Jean awoke to a faint, incessant hissing sound. Moments later, she stood transfixed in the nursery doorway. There before her, suspended in the air, was her infant daughter Jennifer's favorite rattle, beating rhythmically above Jennifer, who lay unmoving, her eyes closed placidly over a smile of bliss. Just a few days later, Karelin delivered his final oration to humanity. George and Jean listened in silence. They had already learned the worst and the best from Rashavarak. The overlords, it was at last revealed, had come to Earth ultimately not as masters, but as midwives. From time immemorial, their race had lived in the service of a vast, disembodied, directive network of power, which they called the Overmind. Of its origins and purposes, they knew little, only that it pervaded the universe and yet remained somehow unfinished, seeking endlessly to expand the depth of its wholeness and awareness by merging with ripening sources of consciousness and creativity. And just such a source, teetering at the evolutionary crosspoint between self-annihilation and exaltation, was Karelin's collective mass of humanity. Now mankind was at last about to be liberated from its earthly prison of animal individuality. Now, at last, the human race would rise into cosmic consciousness. Except, of course, for those over the age of 10. With the onset of adolescence, Terrans were unredeemable, hopelessly sealed off from breakthrough under the armor of individuality. Only the children of Earth would inherit the heavens. The Gregson children had been the first chosen. Jean, during that long-ago African seance, had connected with the Overmind. And she could only have done so, Rashavarak surmised, through the medium of a child, her then-unconceived son-to-be, Jeffrey. And now, The chain reaction was accelerating. Very soon, children the world over would be conveyed to the remote interior of Australia, there to join together in an endless chain, dancing in wordless rhythm for months and years, while their minds expanded and blended, until they were ready to rise to their waiting destiny. "My work here is nearly ended," Karelin concluded in his oration. But he did not speak with the ringing tones of triumph. For in fact, the overlords had come to Earth with a dual mission. First, and obviously, to incubate humanity within the safe, nurturing climate that would ensure a productive breakthrough for the Overmind. But they had also come, just as they had come before, to other worlds on the verge of breakthrough, to search for their own salvation. And in this search, they had once again failed. Intellectually, the overlords were far superior to the Terrans. "Yet," confessed Karelin, "there is something in your minds that has always eluded us. Our minds have reached the end of their development. So, in their present form, have yours. Yet you can make the jump to the next stage. And therein lies the difference between us." So the overlords, with all their superb analytical and technological powers, would return again to their home world as barren midwives, still lacking the essential spirit or circuitry that might have made them into priests, poets, artists, and prophets, that one day might have lifted them into the Overmind. Decades passed away, but due to the time displacement of faster-than-light travel, the stowaway Jan Rodericks, now returning to Earth after his 80-odd-year odyssey among the overlords, had aged only 6 months. He found himself back home on a doomed and deserted planet. Of his race, only the one-time children remained, silently awaiting their liberation. Now, very soon, like a growing plant that consumes the seed which originated and nourished it, the children would swell, merge, and vanish into the Overmind, absorbing the Earth itself in their cosmic journey. "When our ships entered your skies a century and a half ago," Karelin reminded the desolate Jan, "you feared and recognized us. We became identified with your race's death, even while it was 10,000 years in the future." It was time for the overlords to leave. Jan, however, chose to stay behind. The last of a noble race, he awaited the ultimate exaltation and annihilation of his kind. And it was not long in coming. The Earth trembled slightly, then shimmered as its children, in a violent outward spinning wind, finally burst the bonds of their own flesh, devouring the fragile chrysalis that had nurtured them. In his last radio transmissions to the overlords, Jan described the tumultuous escape of the Earth's atmosphere and his own ghostly weightlessness as the planetary mass whirled into a pinwheel of disintegration. The transmissions ended in a blur of static. And looking down from the lonely height of the stratosphere, Karelin silently saluted the men and women he had known on the vanished planet. "Remember this," he had told them in his last message. "We will always envy you." In Childhood's End, Arthur C. Clarke celebrates humankind's spirituality, the force that drives us to transcend, to create, to connect, to prophesy in a realm beyond words. And in fact, from his seat in the 1950s when this book was written, Clarke himself proved to be a remarkable prophet. Perhaps this prescience stands as testimony enough to the validity of the mysterious Ouija board message. Believe in man. Nature is with you. And the world, our world, may end not in a holocaust after all, but in a triumphant metamorphosis.